Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. And today we're broadcasting from the Jackson Hole Summit here in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Very exciting. The central bank is the issue. Is it the problem or the solution? I have a very good friend of mine here, Professor Larry White, and he is the esteemed professor of economics at George Mason University, and he is a scholar on monetary policy and a hardcore libertarian. Well, he's an economist. He sees things as they are, and it just so happens to prove libertarians right. Aren't we lucky? Professor, thanks for the show.
Good to be here.
Yeah,
good to talk to
thanks
you.
For coming on. So I took a class from the professor at the Foundation for Economic Education on the topic of free banking. And not free basing, all you libertarian drug-addled, you know, freakos. This is free banking. And if you've never heard of this, free banking is the concept. Well, I'll let the professor tell you. Tell me, Professor, what is free banking?
It's the concept that the market can handle payment systems as they did, as markets did, as entrepreneurs did before governments came in and started trying to control things. Mm-hmm. Go back as far back in history as you like, and you get privately minted coins till governments see that's a profitable business, they take that over. You get privately issued paper money redeemable for gold and silver. Governments create central banks to monopolize that because it's a profitable business, and they when you monopolize it, and they get revenue from it. So that's been the fight, markets against governments and money.
It's not surprising that governments are going to want to step in and control the supply, the flow of money. And for people that don't know, central banking has a long and sordid history in the United States, but we didn't always have a central bank. Well, and in fact, the Federal Reserve is the third central bank that the United States has had. So can you tell us, Professor, just a little bit about the history of central banking in the United States? Why did we get rid of it twice, and how did it come back?
Well, it's a long story. The first and second banks of the United States were projects of the party, the Hamiltonians, who wanted a stronger federal government. So it was going to be a fiscal agent for the federal government. It was going to help collect taxes and disperse federal spending. But the Jeffersonians were able to put it down twice. They said, look, it's not authorized by the Constitution. It's a kind of favoritism because the shareholders have the exclusive right to have a bank that goes across state lines. Other banks aren't allowed to do that. That's not fair. And then third, and this was especially Jackson's argument in killing the second bank, it's making business cycles bigger. They say they manage the currency, but they mismanage the currency. So that was the end of the second bank. It wasn't renewed. And the United States went until 1913 before we got the Federal Reserve Act.
A lot of people, they don't really pay attention to monetary policy. They think when they're talking about monetary policy, they're like, oh, does that include taxes? Well, you know, there's two different types of policy when it comes to money. There's monetary policy, and then there's fiscal policy. I like to joke that monetary policy is where money is created, and fiscal policy is where it's destroyed. that's a very nerdy insider central banking joke there. But
that's a good one.
Yeah, well, yeah. So the difference between monetary policy, of course, is that, and that's what the concept of this event is about, is that monetary policy is really about where does money come from. Who controls money? Who controls the supply of money? And right now we have this sort of quasi-public-private institution, the Federal Reserve. It's neither public and completely public, and it's not nor completely private. Do you think that the Federal Reserve wants to sort of have it both ways, that the central bank wants to be private when they don't want any scrutiny, like an audit of the Fed, and then they want to be public when they want, you know, Congress to step in and help them with a bailout or something?
They do take advantage of that ambiguity. So the Federal Reserve Act created 12 regional reserve banks that were supposed to do clearing services and basically technical operations, and they were owned by the banks that were participating, so they were like co-ops. It wasn't voluntary. Federally chartered banks had to buy shares, that is, they had to chip in the money to start these banks. But over time, it's become more and more controlled by the center. So the 12 regional reserve banks don't have their own policies anymore. They just execute the Board of Governors, the Washington, D.C. policy. Mm-hmm. So it's still nominally privately owned by the shareholders, and if you're an employee of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, you're not a federal employee, you're not on the federal pay scale, And so they sometimes use that to say, well, we're not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests and so on. But when it comes down to who calls the shots, it's the political appointees, the Board of Governors. They're appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. They're on the federal pay scale. They determine the budgets for the entire Federal Reserve System, all the regional reserve banks, and they determine the policies. So the private part is now just nominal. It doesn't give anybody control over the system except the political appointees.
All right, Professor, I love money. Dirty, sexy money. Now, would ending the Federal Reserve System put more money in my pocket? Because I think that's probably the question that most people want to know. Would ending the Federal Reserve actually be a good thing for people like me, consumers, and people who are capitalists, who are small business owners? Would ending the Fed result in more dirty, sexy money in my pocket?
Well, it wouldn't be like a free lunch for everybody. Mm-hmm. It would mean a sounder economy, an economy that would be more steady, because the Fed has not, you know, reduced instability in the economy. Despite the economy being much more diversified, it's just as volatile as it was back in the 19th century. So I think the Fed's made a negative contribution there. And the Fed, of course, has created a lot more inflation than the gold standard did.
Well, what is inflation?
Inflation is when the value of the money in your pocket is eroded. It's like adding water to milk. You got the same amount of nutrition, but you got to drink more ounces to get it.
So the Fed inflates our currency and
devalues it. The Fed inflates our currency, and the money you've already got drops in value. So it's a tax on people holding money.
Right.
The government prints up new money. They get to spend that. And what's left in your pocket doesn't buy as much.
Now, I know you don't have a lot of time, Professor, and I don't want to monopolize your time because you're like the rock star guy who started this today, and everybody wants a piece of your time.
Uh-huh.
But I want to talk about free banking again. I want to get into this because, again, this is like a lot of libertarians don't even know about this concept. They don't understand sort of the mechanics of how a free market monetary system would work. You know, Friedrich Hayek wrote a book called, it was actually a lecture, A Free Market Monetary System, and in it he said that when government controls the supply of money, we'll never know what good money is going to be because we've never had an opportunity to create our own money. So can you?
Well,
help
I think
us?
I think
is
we did
true?
Have. I think that's an exaggeration. Actually, I think we did have free banking systems before central banks took over everywhere, and it meant commercial banks competing with each other issued their own paper currency. So instead of just having one face on a $5 bill, you'd had your choice of a dozen different faces issued by different banks, but they're all interchangeable. But the competition kept each bank on its toes. You couldn't have inflationary monetary policy. You couldn't have crazy zero interest rate policy. Everybody is a participant in a competitive market rather than there being a central controller. Mm-hmm. There's not a monopolist. There's not a central planner of the monetary system. So the best example of this is the Scottish banking system from about 1716 to 1844. Lots of competing banks of issue, a very competitive system. The difference between what they paid you on your deposits and what they charged on loans was very small. That's a sign of a competitive system. The banknotes, as I said, circulated at par, meaning one for one with each other. So it wasn't any more confusing for people than having different names on their checks. But it meant no one bank could ruin the system. No one bank could cause a big ruckus the way the Federal Reserve can in the monetary system as a whole. When the Fed, you know, decides to loosen money, we get inflation.
United we stand, united we fall.
Yeah, we've got all our eggs in one basket. So we rely on this committee of wise men to make a woman at the top now, to make decisions for us. And when they make a mistake, it's a doozy. It's better to, you know, diversify things.
All right, so I want to get a little wonky because a lot of my listeners are like super into this stuff, and I want to give them a little red meat. One of the topics that you talked about today was the gold standard, and it's sort of a buzzword around here. We're talking about gold and the gold standard. But I'm going to challenge you a little bit, Professor, and I want to ask you a tough question here. Isn't a gold standard still fiat? I mean, if the government is controlling the gold standard, I mean, isn't it still central planning? Isn't free banking the more anarchic sort of system that's proposed here, isn't that really what we're going for? Because everybody here is talking about this gold standard, and to me, it's like, why do you want a gold standard? Government will still control it.
So gold standard means that the basic unit of money is a unit of gold.
Okay.
Now, you can either have that with a central bank on top, as you're suggesting, controlled by the government, which controls all the other kinds of money, and then you're right, it's not that much better.
Mm-hmm.
It's subject to manipulation. It's subject to boom and bust cycles coming from the central bank. That's what we saw historically. Free banking says, no, decentralize that so nobody has that kind of power over the system. And then, yeah, it manages itself. The quantity of money in the system regulates itself instead of some committee of wizards trying to regulate it from the center. Mm-hmm. And that works better. I mean, that's the historical evidence.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're a conservative or a libertarian, you need to get on this issue, because it may sound boring, but it's, you know, think about the money in your pocket about it. It's all pocketbook. It's all about the money. And free banking is, to me, the central, it is the central thesis to the economic freedom, because where your money is created, where it comes from, where it's born, the genesis of money, is where all of our economic growth comes from.
Let me say this. It's not gold or free banking. It's gold and free banking.
Okay.
So gold makes the basic money non-political.
Mm-hmm.
It's a commodity. It's produced by a competitive mining industry that nobody controls. Nobody from the center controls.
I can just see.
And then banks provide sort of more convenient payment methods than carrying sacks of gold coins around. But that's their basic function, to make payments more convenient, and of course borrowing and lending more convenient.
Okay, quick thoughts on Bitcoin.
Bitcoin's an amazing thing. It's not something I would have predicted. It works on a very different principle. So gold standard with free banking works on the principle that the money has a money-back guarantee. You can take your banknote back to the bank and cash it in for gold, and you know how many ounces of gold you're going to get. So it's like a fixed price, if you want to call it that. Bitcoin doesn't have that. Bitcoin has a fixed quantity. Right? They say, this is how many bitcoins are in existence. You can check the public ledger. You can see that. Here's the path they're going to be on. You can check the source code.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all out there. So we can't hyperinflate it. You don't have to worry about anybody cranking an electronic printing press to erode the value of Bitcoin. But that means that every time there's a blip up or down in the demand for it, the price goes up and down, not the quantity. And that makes it a little difficult to use as an ordinary method of payment. I mean, you don't want to have your rent check sitting in your Bitcoin account, and then the value of Bitcoin goes down the day before your rent's due.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem for Bitcoin achieving a really critical mass as a payment medium. But I think it's an amazing thing, and the technology of it has all kinds of applications beyond payment mechanisms that we'll just have to wait to see what entrepreneurs bring us, but it has great promise.
Professor, you are the intellectual spearhead for the economic reform movement of libertarians in this country, and I am really highly encouraging my audience to get out there and to do some Googling. Look up free banking on YouTube and Vimeo. Professor White's lectures are out there. He's also got quite a few books I'd like to hear.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your books here.
Okay, you have to Google my books under Lawrence H. White.
Yeah. Lawrence H. White.
He's a Marxist with the same name.
The most recent is called The Clash of Economic Ideas, and it's about the battle between free market ideas and statist ideas, basically,
mm-hmm.
as it's played out over the last 100 years, especially.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a history of economic thought, but only the really juicy parts, only
right.
the good parts.
Good, good. That's the kind of stuff my people like to hear. And you got a few other books, too. You want to just plug those for me? Or?
The Theory of Monetary Institutions. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you can find that selling for a few dollars on secondary markets. My first book is called Free Banking in Britain, and that's where I talk about this historical episode of free banking mm-hmm. before it was quashed in Scotland. And that's available as a free download from iea.org.uk.
Mm. All right. Well, Professor Lawrence White of George Mason Institution, the university, thank you very much for coming on the Freedom Report podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to the show today. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher, Stitcher.com. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Don't forget to go. This month, we are sponsored by Purple Pack, purplepack.org, holding a contest, $10,000 for your best ideas on how to get Rand Paul elected. That's $2,000 apiece for 5 people. Don't forget to sign up, purplepack.org/contest. And this ad is not paid by any candidate or candidates committee. Don't forget to come back every single day to your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at the libertarianrepublic.com.